Hey guys, welcome to the latest episode of the Marvel Bronze Age. I'm Ed.
And I'm Levi with the most recent episode of the Marvel Bronze Age.
This being episode 11, two books, which is pretty typical for us that we have to talk about this evening or today or this afternoon or whenever the hell you listen to this.
Now.
It is.
And then now.
Yes.
And then now.
Now. You must listen now. And me, I would just pause it like 5 seconds and then play it.
Now.
Our first all horror themed show actually just turned out that way. It wasn't planned. I wish we could plan it that well, but we didn't.
Yeah, it's like, wow, you guys really worked that out.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah.
Two books.
See how that works?
Yeah. We have Tower of Shadows, issue 4, and Where Monsters Dwell, issue 2. In doing a little bit of research, let's see which one it was. One of these, and it is Tower of Shadows, is a reprint book, it turns out.
That would explain the heavy theme of the first story there.
It did feel kind of out of place in 1970.
Yeah, that was a definite heavy 60s vibe going on there.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Let me see. No, I've got that backwards. I'm sorry.
Really?
Yeah, no. Tower of Shadows was not. Those were all original stories.
So they did that on purpose?
Yeah. What I'm showing here is when they were reprinted. Okay, my fault. Yeah, that came out the first time. At the time this book came out. So, Where Monsters Dwell is the one that's a reprint book. The first story, there were two stories in it. The first one, both of them came out in 1960.
Mm.
So, that was, 10 years? Yeah, 10 mm-hmm. years that we're reading this. One was in, well, I'll get to that in a minute because that's our second book. Tower of Shadows, first book up. Some pretty big names if you are a name follower of this time period. The cover was drawn by Marie Severin, and Levi and I had a long discussion last episode about the fact that I thought that was a male. It was inked by Herb Trimpe, colored also by Marie Severin, and lettered by Sam Rosen. In this issue, Tower of Shadows 4, there were three stories, each of them 7 pages long. And we had Alan Brodsky and Don Heck.
Hold on a sec.
Go ahead.
You said Rosen did what?
Rosen did the letters for the cover.
Oh, okay. And the first name was what?
Sam.
Okay.
Sam Rosen.
Okay. Sorry, I thought you said something else. Okay, never mind.
Okay. And it's funny that there would actually be somebody credited because, I mean, you've got the title of the book, which probably was already set.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the thing up there in the corner, whatever that's called, that shows the price and the mm-hmm. issue number. That's all set, I'm sure. You have almost like a text bubble that says Tales to Blow Your Mind, and then at the bottom of the cover is within the witching circle.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I guess somebody had to do it, but I would think that maybe the editor would just throw something together or, you know, something to get it done rather than something that you had to pay somebody for.
Right.
So, but the first story was written by Alan Brodsky with pencils and inks by Don Heck, and it too was lettered. Actually, everything in the book was lettered. Well, no, I'm sorry. The first and second story lettered by Sam Rosen. The second story was written by Marv Wolfman and penciled by Gene Colan, inked by Dan Adkins. The Wolfman-Colan duo is a particular favorite of mine from this time period, and they would go on to do some excellent work in a Dracula book that Marvel is going to have coming up here in the next little bit. Tomb of Dracula was the name of it.
Mm.
And then the third story was Let's see how they did this. It was plotted by Tom Sutton, but it was written by Denny O'Neill, penciled and inked by Tom Sutton, and it was lettered, though, by Gene Izzo. So for me, Sutton, O'Neill, Adkins, Colin, Wolfman, Rosen, Heck, and Brodsky, all those names are familiar with me from the Bronze Age. The only person I don't believe I've run into that I know of is Gene Izzo. Off the top of my head, I don't remember anything standing out in my mind that I have read that I would flag that it was lettered mm-hmm. by him or her, whichever way it went.
Yeah, you're not going to say definitely now,
no,
are you?
No, not anymore. Not without looking it up beforehand. All right, so first up is this Tower of Shadows, the first story. So I guess it's Tower of Shadows 4.1. And interesting, like Levi said, it's an interesting story. It definitely has a very 60s beatnik vibe because I guess it wouldn't be beatnik. It would have been hippie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be beatnik now, but very hippies, the male and the female dressed like it, headbands, the clothing, the style of clothing, the patterns, male and female that are together. Don't know, boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife. Doesn't really matter for the story. The husband, that's an assumption on my part, and that may not be accurate. The male has invited someone over that goes by the name Alistair. Brother Alistair, A-L-I-S-T-A-R. Now, immediately that put me in mind of Aleister Crowley.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they were alluding to him. Given what happens and what the person does in the story, I would think that they're trying to make some kind of connection there, but I don't know. But they ran into him, and he needed a place to come and do some of his stuff that the female doesn't seem to be too into, but the male does kind of want to be a part of that, you know, kind of funky hoodoo stuff that Alistair says he can do. So he invited Alistair over to his place because he needed a quiet place to do some magic-y stuff. The female is kind of put off because she feels that it's the dark kind.
Yeah, it's black magic.
The guy, though, is like, you know, baby, it's all the same. It's all good. No big deal. You know, we'll just watch and see what happens. So Alistair does come over. He immediately sets to work chalking a pentagram on the floor. Not only is it a pentagram, but it's a pentagram within a circle with all kinds of other symbols and words in it and everything. I mean, it's this big elaborate thing. Candles set up and everything. So it's not a simple thing that he comes and does in their house.
Nope.
Or in their apartment. Upper floor apartment too, as you can see in one panel.
Yep.
And I don't know, for some reason I get the feeling that this is out in California, you know, somewhere, San Francisco maybe, or so. I don't know why. I guess maybe because of the hippiness. But Alistair wants to conjure a demon and has gone to all the trouble with the pentagram and the markings because that will allow him to control it once he summons it. So he hums and mutters his incantation and summons a demon, kind of abominable snowman looking.
Mm-hmm.
He's bigger than a human being, kind of white, shaggy fur.
And scales.
Scales on the nose and on the midriff and groin.
Mm-hmm.
But the scales are like the same color as its fur. Mm-hmm. So the colorist didn't, you know, change anything. Just everything was white. Except the eyes. The eyes are red.
Mm-hmm.
So in the midst of explaining to the demon why he was summoned, as Alistair was doing, the couple's cat runs across the pentagram and breaks it.
Breaks the circle.
Thus allowing the demon to escape the circle,
mm-hmm.
which it immediately does, grabs Alistair and disappears. Our frame of reference is following Alistair, who subsequently appears in hell or some level of hell or some like place. In comic books, it's hard to say exactly what it is, but the impression they give you is that it's in hell.
Yeah, it's an infernal realm, whatever it is.
Yeah, whichever one you want to call it. And the man in charge down there is familiar with Alistair and tells Alistair that now that he's down there, he'll be able to give him everything that he's always wanted. The demon pops back up in the room of the couple and touches them. Now, this I didn't quite understand, Levi. Tell me what your impression of this was. They are drawn as disappearing much the same way Alistair did.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't show up in hell.
Mm-mm.
Rather, they're transported in time.
Yeah, they're basically put into their own bit of hell.
Their own hell,
yeah.
I guess? Okay. Which their hell is of everyday people with workaday jobs, and she's a mom who is not given her due course by her husband. He works for the Rushmore Insurance Company. We can tell because it's on his briefcase. And we have a narrator here, but he's not overly – I mean, there's nothing that really stands out about him. So,
well, the reason that they did this is because of comments that the dude made, the hippie dude made, back a page or two, I guess. And, you know, it was like, so what do we care if the uptight types or what the uptight types call it? You know, evil, whatever. We make our own rules. We're not suburban squares tied down in a 9-to-5 rut.
Oh, okay.
And so because that obviously is what I guess they fear the most or is the greatest evil to them.
Right. That would be their hell, yeah. I guess, to have to live through that. So
yeah.
They are transported into living that life.
Yep.
Meh. Okay.
Yeah.
The second story, the point two in this issue, starts out with a couple gentlemen discussing business over a meal. And we find out that one gentleman is pushing another gentleman to make business decisions that has ruined him. They appear to be friends. I guess before this happened, they were apparently friends. The one is taking advantage of the other. And in the midst of their conversation, they are interrupted by what we would assume, because I don't believe it said, did it, Levi, is a gypsy?
I don't remember if it specified, but I mean, you got the – well, no, let's see here. I think it did at the end.
Yeah, does he refer to her as a gypsy?
Yeah. I believe
she appears
so.
– she's got a head wrap on. She's got big earrings. She's got a very exposed – décolleté.
Can you say that on here?
Décolleté?
Yeah.
Yes. Actually, that word you can say.
Oh.
The word us street people know it as, I was trying to avoid. So.
Right, okay.
But she asks if either one of them want their fortune told, their palms read. And she immediately grabs up. Let's see. Peter is the one that's being bilked, but the one doing it, let's see if it says his name here. Mike. Mike is the bad guy. Peter is the one being taken advantage of. She grabs up Mike's hand and she like rape reads his hand. He doesn't want it. But she grabs a hold and keeps hold so that she can see what's going to happen to him because he's being such a wiener about it. And ultimately, of course, she tells him that he is going to come to some kind of ruin, which, as these stories go, that's what you would expect. Her name is Lola, so we have Lola is – she was a showgirl, mm-hmm. Yes, with diamonds in her hair and a dress cut down to there, exposing the décolleté. So, Lola – Mike is the bad guy and Peter is the poor – victim. So Lola tells Mike that he is going to die, or excuse me, she says, "You will die." W-E-E-L. And that accent has been all through her talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
Levi and I talked a little bit before show, and we came to the conclusion that this is Russian, Eastern Bloc-ish accent is what this is supposed to be. Which, oddly enough, comes up again in this issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where monsters dwell. Yeah. So that very, perhaps, same accent comes up again. But Lola tells Mike that he's going to die in the presence of an Indian. Then she just turns and leaves so abruptly that she bumps into another couple, all the while Mike yelling after her, you know, wait, you can't just leave it there. You know, you've got to tell me more. Mike and Peter leave. Mike, being the nice guy that he is, says, come on, Pete, cheer up. Be thankful that I was the one who took advantage of you. It could have been a total stranger, you know. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's comforting.
Exactly. That makes it all better.
You're a big wiener. So he walks Mike to his room, and then he walks
to the elevator.
Pete. He walks Pete to the elevator. Mike leaves with Lola's declaration of his impending doom running around in his head. He passes a dime store Indian, one of the wooden carved Indians, and something throws him off. He thinks he sees it move, I think is what it was.
No, it's just he's sitting there and he's like, that's funny. It's, you know, I guess it's coincidence. There's got to be hundreds of these things, you know, in the city. So, no, it doesn't mean anything that I happen to see this now here.
So it's funny that he ran into one, yeah. Is what he's – okay. And as he's going through this in his head, a portion of the top of the building breaks off and falls.
Which I liked what they said here. That solid block of granite that has been waiting 50 years to fall just for you. I thought that was a nice touch. It's like, dun, dun, dun.
He's saved by a passerby who noticed. So he escapes that, shakes him. He goes home, gets to his office, that's where he's going, and calls in his secretary, and his secretary walks in dressed like an Indian.
Yeah.
She just says, how do you like my new Indian dress? And the outfit is one thing, but she's got a headband with a lone feather in the back.
Yep.
The Brave Et headdress, or whatever you want to call that. I don't even know what that is.
Yeah.
But she has it on. And he freaks out and starts, you know, backing away from her, and ultimately she saves him from backing and falling out his window. So he runs off, shaken even more because yet again here's this Indian thing.
And a near-death experience.
Yeah. As he's wandering down the street, he encounters some boys playing cowboys and
Indians.
Indians, yes indeed. And in watching them, almost gets hit by a car. Only to jump out of the way at the last moment. Finally makes it to – he's trying to get home because he knows if he can get home, you know, he'll be safe because there's nobody else there. So he gets to his building, jumps on the elevator, and as he's waiting to ride the elevator up, it's stopped by someone that asks Mike to hold his urn while he just, you know, steps right out here and – brings his luggage into the elevator, too. He had too much to carry everything at one time. So he hands Mike the urn, and Mike's standing there holding it, and he says, what's inside this? And the gentleman that handed it to him says, ashes, sir, the most revered ashes of my departed father. And if you go to the panel before this, you see that this gentleman is wearing a turban.
Mm-hmm.
Or
a head what I call some sort.
Yeah, what I call a turban. It may actually be called something else. He says, the ambassador from India. And then Mike starts choking up, the ambassador from, and then the elevator breaks free, the brakes fail, the cable fails, and he plummets to his death in the presence
of an Indian den. And by the way, to clear it up, he wasn't actually at his apartment. He was in the skyscraper that the Skytop restaurant was in Where Lola Works.
Oh, he was going back to talk to her.
Yeah, okay. Outside, he was like, I've got to see the gypsy. So that's where he was going, because he was wanting to, you know, get the curse reversed or, you know, done away with, because
I guess it's,
you know, he was freaking out, and had he just been calm, like, nothing would have happened. Like, you know, the first time, if he had just kept walking, he'd have been clear of the falling debris. If he hadn't freaked out because of his secretary, he wouldn't have gone through an open window in a building.
Right, yeah.
And if he had not been standing there, you know, like, oh my God, they're playing cowboys and Indians, then he would have seen the car coming. I mean,
right. He would have gotten out of the path long before the car was there. Yeah. So,
and had he not been obsessed with seeing her, where would he have not been when this happened?
On a faulty elevator.
There you go.
Yep. But for, I believe, is the legal term for that.
Yes.
But for the way he was acting, he probably wouldn't have found this himself in these various positions.
Yes, exactly.
All right, the third, and for me, probably the story that I liked the most. I liked it because of it didn't seem to take itself as seriously as the first two.
No, but I also liked how it ended.
Okay. Plus, this one had a very different perspective, which I liked also.
Yes.
This story, okay, the first two stories, we follow a person and we are being narrated to, which is the typical comic book kind of thing. The typical, I guess, just about anything.
Yeah, that was a bit annoying, but okay.
You know, you're watching from, I guess, what would it be? Would it be first person? Watching? Chef Terry, does that make sense? The normal comic book reading, is that a first-person perspective?
Wouldn't that be second person, first person being the person?
First person being who you're watching, so it would be second person?
Yeah, wouldn't that be it?
You know, honestly, I don't know. That sounds right, but off the top of my head, I don't know. But a narrator, and we are observing the characters. In this third story, the narrator is a house.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are we being narrated to by the house, but we are also getting the house's thoughts as a character.
Yep. As a sentient being.
Yes. And the house is observing a couple gentlemen pull up in the midst of a rainstorm, one dark and, of course, now stormy
night.
Yes. And they drive up to this house, and these guys have some – just they have accents also.
Oh yeah,
yeah. One is named Fredor, I guess is how you would pronounce that. F R I E D O R.
Yeah, I wasn't sure, so I was just like
Fredor.
I was Fredor.
Fredor. And that is the small, mad scientist, brainy looking one, because he's short. He's got a bald head and really big glasses.
No, Fredor is the big guy.
I'm sorry. Yeah. We have two. Fredor is the big henchman.
He's bent over. Yeah, he's bent over. He's got shaggy hair, kind of.
Less intelligent.
He seems to be.
Of the pair.
Yes.
And then Fredor refers to the other one, the evil scientist-y kind of guy, as my leader. Mm-hmm. That's all he ever calls him, my leader. So they drive up to this house. Fredor is driving. My leader is directing. And my leader determines that this is the perfect location because it overlooks the top secret plutonium plant.
Yes.
Okay. So they go inside, and we get to look around as they're looking around. Again, it is being narrated by the very building around them.
Mm-hmm.
So the narration is talking about the fact that these two creatures are moving around inside it. They're giving off this air that the house can feel, and it's not pleasant. It doesn't like the air that these two men are giving off.
Mm-hmm.
As they're looking around, the house decides to perhaps try to run them off. It says that It relaxes. It reacts by relaxing the grip of nails on wood. And basically, at one point, my leader falls through a internal balcony overhang. He was on the upper portion and falls through. Fredor has caught him, though, so he is unharmed. It doesn't seem like my leader really liked the fact that he caught him.
No, but I mean, he gave him a lot of crap for that, man, calling him an idiot, a dolt, and a witling.
Yeah, it's yeah. Then they go on down to the basement, and it's for this kind of house, it was a very interesting basement, I thought.
Oh, no kidding. I was like, damn.
The house, the upper part of the house, the habitable part, shall we say, looked very much like your typical gothically designed house.
Yeah, it says that it's a century old, and I mean, you've got to expect that the house after 100 years is going to be extremely dilapidated.
Yes, apparently there was no one living in it. So I think being dilapidated at this point would be very likely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, perhaps that could have explained why he fell through that one portion of the house.
Right.
Rather than anything that the house would have done. Because, I mean, you know, the house being sentient would have just been, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so with that, dilapidated was our word of the show that was suggested to us over Twitter by Toothnasher.
Toothnasher. Good word. Yeah.
So those of you who are on Twitter, and as a reward for Toothnasher submitting the word of the show, wish to follow him or her, by all means, Toothnasher is standard spelled, so you should be able to find them. Thank you very much, Toothnasher. Apparently you do listen to the show, or else you wouldn't have known to offer a word of the show to us, so hopefully you'll listen to this episode and hear your shout-out.
There you go.
But the bottom of this house, and I guess it would be the basement or the
dungeon.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Yes, that's exactly what it looks
huge
like.
Huge vaulted ceilings, mm-hmm, and vaulted walkways, fixtures on the wall. And yeah, it looks very dungeony rather than like just a basement.
Mm-hmm. And there's like an iron ring with chains in one corner and steel grated circular, I don't even know, drainage maybe, but it's like in the middle of the wall.
Now, over on that panel, all the way over on the right hand side, those aren't tombstones, are they?
Hold on.
In front of that?
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. Now that you mention it, I've got to look because I hadn't paid attention to those.
There's an old chair there, and it looks like an old chest with some cobwebs on it, maybe. And I'm like,
that's not a chest.
Oh, a coffin?
A coffin or some sort of mausoleum insert.
Okay, do you think those are tombstones?
Well, blowing it up and looking at them now, yes, I do.
Okay.
I do.
So that's, guys, what's in the bottom of this house that Fredor and my leader have – I don't bought or are using. You know?
I don't know.
Later on, they get a truck to pull up with equipment so they can unload equipment. So they must have some kind of ability to use this house that other people won't be concerned about the fact that now trucks are driving up delivering stuff.
Well, it's supposed to be out in the middle of nowhere. And what I'm expecting is if it's beside, oddly enough, a top secret uranium plant that,
yes,
it's probably going to be away from prying eyes anyway.
So they just found the house and they're just using it then, you figure?
Yeah, I'm
okay.
Guessing.
I mean, we can go with that. Yeah. Okay. So they move equipment in with the help of other people here, but the other people don't stay. It's like a delivery service maybe, or, you know, something like that. And then they start assembling the equipment and assemble something with electronic controls that allows them to view – well, no. Either view or target the plutonium plant, because in one panel we see them looking at a view screen that is circular in nature, but it has a big crosshair on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the targeting system if I ever saw one.
Right. And then in the very next panel on the next page, mm-hmm. which is about half of that page, we see kind of a cutout of the portion of the house that they have worked on. Mm-hmm. And in the basement is all this equipment with a long tower going up to this platform holding what appears to be some sort of ray device mm-hmm. pointed in the direction of the plutonium plant. And then we see my leader telling us what is going on, as bad guys are apt to do. Mm-hmm. He says, special critical mass booster in tower is ready to bombard factory with beam, which makes instant atomic bomb of entire stockpile. Now, I'm not misreading it. That's part of his accent.
That's how it's written.
Yeah, that's how it's written. I guess when you learn another language, you don't learn the prepositions and things like that. You just learn the verbs, adverbs, and nouns. I don't know.
I know the prepositions of Appalachian American just fine, so.
Well, yeah, it's another language.
It is.
When I took German, I had to learn prepositions also, mm-hmm. but. So now we find out what their plan is. This whole time, this is maybe the first time that we've really seen the outside in a little while. Still major, or not still, but there's a major storm raging this night as well. I don't think it was raining when they moved their equipment in during the day or in the evening, but the night they first went to the house and this night, there's major storm with lightning and heavy rain both nights. So in this part of the country, our country, I would imagine, it only rains at night. Not that that's not impossible, but okay. So we find also Fredor is asking some very good questions. He asks my leader, well, if we're going to blow up this building right next door to us, won't that blow us up too? And he is informed that no. Because having thought of everything, my leader has contacted someone that is going to fly in and remove them in time to safely get away from whatever explosion they cause. So they set about making their final adjustments and fine-tuning this ray. And as they get ready to fire the weapon, sure enough, a pretty cool looking aircraft.
I was going to say, wow, that's a little out of place in this story, but okay.
Yeah, really. I mean, it looks more like a UFO-ish kind of.
It looked like structure. Something the early Fantastic Four would ride in.
Okay, yeah. So they have set the machinery, the beam in motion here. They're escaping out into the aircraft in the midst of this huge storm. Now, the house, meanwhile, is not liking what they're doing to the house itself, but also it seems that the house recognizes that their intent for the plutonium plant is not wholesome.
Mm.
These are evil men set about an evil task. On top of the fact that they are doing things to me. Me being the house, that I don't like. So the house is doubly or triply upset. Turns out that in the past at some point, there were magical machinations that were done in the house that imbued the house with this intelligence. Also, the house was imbued with the ability to control or summon magic itself.
Mm-hmm.
My thought is perhaps the magic that has animated it to the level that it's been animated rather than controlling magic as does Doctor Strange mm-hmm. or a practitioner does. More the control of the ambient rather than the creating it or calling it in from some remote source.
Right.
So it grabs a hold of the magic that it has and starts controlling the weather immediately surrounding it, causing the winds to pick up. The winds start to damage the grounds, damage the house. throws the plane about like a toy, and in the midst of its buffeting around, the house summons a huge lightning strike that strikes the aircraft and completely disables it, sending it crashing into the house. And the crashing of the flying vehicle plus the lightning strike itself causes this device that had been constructed to blow up, everything being completely destroyed. The house, the flying vessel, the device inside it. And in the end, the house's consciousness lingers until the first rays of the morning. And then the narration says, "You linger on until the first rays of the morning. You view the torn site where you stood and the gleaming government building beyond. Symbol of an age that has no place for haunted houses. Then you fade into final peace." And that is the end of our Russian spy plutonium, American plutonium plant story.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. So, Levi, you told me, I think you told me before recording that you were kind of caught off guard by what you got from this book. You were expecting something else when you first opened it up.
Oh, yeah. For some reason, I was expecting black and white.
Okay.
And I mean, like I said, when I saw the front page, I was like, oh, well, you know, because it was in color, and I was like, oh, well, you know, maybe, they just did that to get attention and to, you know, to help with sales. And then I, you know, right. got into it, and it's obviously not black and white, but that was no big deal. That, doesn't really take away from the overall experience.
Okay.
So
what were your thoughts overall, or anything about any particular story, or
the first one? Like I said, it was so 60s hippie heavy.
Okay,
that was a big detractor. Plus that particular story was just a little weak for me, especially how it ended, because it's, you know, it's like, well, the cat broke the circle. One reason why I don't have cats, so they don't break my damn circles.
Exactly. Exactly.
But then, you know, like, the monster after the circle's broken takes Alistar to wherever he takes him, and then makes the hippies live as adults.
Yeah. Unhippie-like.
I know. I was like, wait, so you're making them grow the hell up and stop being hippies, and this is their hell?
That's their punishment. It's like, okay, thanks.
Dude gets taken to some infernal flame world, and they've got to live like grown-ups?
And it's the same.
Yeah.
Just one for one and, you know, the punishment for the other. So, yeah.
So that was, you know, I was like, well, that's kind of dumb.
Okay.
But the second story, I liked the whole, you know, the gypsy thing. I liked how, you know, like I had mentioned, had he not been worrying so much, then the things would have not actually happened to him. And there's probably a, you know, a good possibility that he wouldn't have even known if any of those things had happened.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So it was a self, what is it called? A self-fulfilling prophecy.
Fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
Because, again, like I said, had he not wanted to go find the gypsy, he wouldn't have been in the building, in the elevator, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But I kind of liked that. You know, it's a lesson, and it's like, you know, don't worry so much about stupid shit.
Okay.
So I liked that. And the third one I really liked. I really did, because it was the house. It was a sentient thing. It didn't like their presence. It got that they were evil. It got that they had evil intentions. And in the end, it destroys itself to destroy them, their creation, and to save, ultimately, the nuclear facility.
Right.
But I think also, and it said that it also realized, and yeah, it said at the end, but I think somewhere back in the story too, it realized that it existing in this world today is not something it should be doing. It has no place there anymore.
Right. It was out of place in its existence. Yeah. So, okay.
So, but then the aircraft threw me. I mean, guys, you really got to just look it up. You go through this entire story and it's like, oh, car. And the other thing is that it's the coloring. Like, it's a bright purple.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything else is nice and mute and night and dark and you know, yeah.
Then this bright purple Fantastic Four looking spacecraft thing comes in to pick them up, and it's like, what?
Dude.
Like, whose idea was that?
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, that was more funny than anything else. And then like I said, the ending I really liked.
Okay.
And so overall, the book's going to get a thumbs up for me.
Okay. Okay, let's see. The first story, I was left kind of meh about it. Nothing really stuck out, good or bad. The second story very much put me in mind of a Night Gallery or a Twilight Zone episode. It had that kind of twistiness, I thought, to it at the end. Now, you know, a lot of Twilight Zone episodes will twist back and forth throughout.
Mm-hmm.
That story didn't do that too much, but at the end, I thought it was a funny little twist that holding the urn fulfilled the quote unquote prophecy.
Right. And of course, you know, everyone else is, you know, oh, an Indian there, an Indian there. No, no. There's the Indian.
Right, exactly, yeah.
An actual Indian.
And then, yeah, like you, you know, it makes me wonder if he had had no knowledge, would he have noticed any of these things up to his death? Of course, he would have noticed his death. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and so in not noticing these different things, would he have still been in a position of harm?
Mm-hmm.
Or would it have just been something that happened just minutes after he passed by?
Right.
You know, he would have woke up the next day reading in the newspaper or seeing on the news or something like that. And the third story, I agree with you. I thought it was cool that one of the narrators, it turns out, there was the omniscient narrator, and then there was narration from the house itself,
mm-hmm.
Was an inanimate object. That had gained animacy, I guess you could say. I don't even know if that's a word, but and consciousness, and had even elevated up quite a bit on. I kept thinking of Maslow's hierarchy. That this house was self-aware, mm-hmm. which is the very top.
Yeah,
you know. And I thought, wow, I know human beings that aren't even up there.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm reading a story about a house that is. But, yeah, so I thought that was pretty cool. I'll agree with you. The two stories, the second and third, out of the three, were cool enough for me to give this a thumbs up, mm-hmm. overall. Folks that are interested in Silver Age comics, I think a book like this is really good reading because all three stories were seven pages. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
And they are written and or drawn by some of the big names of the Silver Age. So I think it really gives you an opportunity to sample what the writers and artists can do as far as this type of story. Now, a lot of these people we will run into doing superhero books, and the artists, maybe not as much, but of course the writers, it'll be a lot more difficult to feel the same with the writers because it's a completely different genre. So the feel of a lot of the superhero stories are very different from anything you're going to get with these monster or horror stories.
Right.
But it is still an opportunity to sample so-and-so who wrote, you know, 200 consecutive issues of Fantastic Four. But here's a horror story that they did. And it gives you a chance to sample them from a completely different perspective.
Right. You know, they can sit there and tell you about saving the world, but do they have, you know, a darker side, or are they able to do that that scary idea well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Which the second one, I think, really addresses what I just said about scary ideas and if they're able to do them well.
The
second issue?
Oh, the second book.
Yeah.
Okay. And with that, that leads us into Where Monsters Dwell, issue 2. And as I said, let's see, at the top, both of these stories, one, I created Spore, the thing that could not die, and the second one, I am Dragoom, the flaming invader. let's see, wait a minute, what did I do here? Yeah, okay. And then there's the third story here. I'm sorry, there's three stories in this issue. Taboo, the thing from Murky Swamp. And Taboo normally has two O's, doesn't it? So that's the same name as the word taboo. Mm-hmm. I wonder why they picked that word. Some bigger names in this one, too. Spore was scripted and drawn by the Fantastic Four creators for the first, I don't know, 80 issues or something like that, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, with inks by Dick Ayers and letters by Artie Simic. The second story was also written by Kirby and inked by Ayers. No idea who the scripter was on that one. And then Taboo, the same thing. So the entire book and the cover was penciled and inked by Kirby and Ayers, and then only one story has a writer attributed to it so far, and that was Stan Lee. So the Fantastic Four was not the first place that Kirby and Lee really got together. They had been doing things for Marvel for a while before Marvel started coming out with superhero books. They were doing, we've already read Stan Lee written Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Lee and Kirby did romances.
Yeah.
And now we see that Lee and Kirby did horror stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Those three books, the genres, were the main things going in comic books up until the most recent advent of the superheroes in the early 60s. I think the first Fantastic Four was 61 for Marvel, and then over in DC, and I make a reference to DC because popular lore, I guess, has it that the creation of the Fantastic Four was spurned by the owner of Marvel Comics after seeing what was going on over at DC with the Justice League of America, which had just started. It wasn't even a year old by the time Fantastic Four came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then along with the Justice League, even before them, was this group called the Legion of Superheroes that was popping up here and there. So DC was already into the superhero thing some, but with Fantastic Four, Marvel jumped on with both feet, and in quick succession after Fantastic Four, you have the introduction of things like Ant-Man, Iron Man, the Hulk. You have the reemergence and brushing off of that old 30s and 40s superhero, Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
And they just take off with superheroes from there, which ultimately gets us to where Marvel Comics is now. There were superheroes out way back in the 30s and 40s,
mm-hmm.
the 30s giving us Superman, Batman,
mm-hmm.
the oldest superheroes really that are still around, but other groups, the Justice Society of America, which had an original Green Lantern, the original Flash, Wonder Woman, started out in the late 30s, and you know, so I mean, a lot of those characters have been around. They had just fallen out because after the war, interest changed to cowboys and Indians and horror and romance. So the superheroes just went bye-bye. Now with Fantastic Four, in the early 60s, they have reemerged. And as we're going through the Bronze Age books, we're seeing, if you look through the books, more and more superhero books and less of the romance, Western, and horror books, mm-hmm. because the interest has shifted the other way now, back towards superheroes. Okay, so that is your history. There will be a test at the end of the week. No, I'm kidding.
I quit.
No test?
Nope.
All right, so where monsters dwell. And I believe I brought this up last episode. For those of you that have seen the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, spoiler, Groot had his origin in this book, Where Monsters Dwell. Not in this issue, but so those of you that really are into the cutesy Groot character that they had in the movie, which is really nothing like Groot is, but his origin is in this book, and ultimately we'll end up covering that issue as well. So we start out with the first story talking about Spore, the thing that could not die. And we have a scientist who is looking for a nice, quiet place to do his scientific work. So he buys Frankenstein's castle,
mm-hmm.
and imports equipment and starts doing his work. Now, who knows? Perhaps it's because of his work. Perhaps it's a residual memory of previous generations. The townspeople get upset at what is going on in the castle, whether perceived or imagined, but they rush the castle. They mob the castle one night in the midst of the doctor's experiments, capture him and haul him off. His experiments involve the enlargement of creatures to help, particularly food, to give human population larger food sources. He's talking about enlarging cattle and sheep and poultry. He is just at the early stages of his studies, so using this enlargement device, he is operating on an amoeba. He wants to see if he can get the amoeba to grow, and then he will move to other organisms after, if this experiment proves successful. So he is in the midst of bombarding an amoeba with his enlargement ray when he is carted off,
mm-hmm.
leaving the amoeba in the device, leaving the device on.
Mm-hmm.
So the amoeba grows and grows and grows. And then over a period of a day or maybe two, it grows large enough that it crashes out of the castle, which is possible. Okay. It is moving about with no destination.
Yeah, no purpose.
No purpose. Which is possible. Amoebas are a little bit more directed than that, but it is possible. Okay. So it is just ambling in the direction of the town and starts tearing up the town. In the midst of this quote-unquote attack, even though the amoeba isn't doing it on purpose, it's not a directed, poignant thing,
mm-hmm.
the doctor escapes his imprisonment, saves a child in the process, proving he's not entirely a bad guy. And he and the villagers are outside of the town watching as this amoeba is destroying the town. The doctor, trying to come up with a plan to stop this, what he can do to change things. Well, it turns out that one of the townspeople got the idea, he and perhaps some of the other townspeople, to try to blow up the amoeba. So they set some charges, and I think it was on a timer.
I don't know. The way it was written makes it sound like it was like this haphazard happenstance, because he's like, the gentleman who did it, he's like, wait, I placed some dynamite back there. It's due to explode in seconds. Let us pray that will destroy him. And I'm like, wait a minute. You did what? Why? Why did you do it?
Yeah.
Where? What were you doing at the time? Were you clearing a creek? Were you help making a road? What were you doing? Why? You know, because he's like, wait, I placed some dynamite back there. with no further explanation.
Well, actually, I bet it's because this is Alfred Nobel, who, for those of you that are familiar with Alfred Nobel, he is the creator of dynamite. He used to operate on a in a workshop that was out in the middle of a lake because he knew how dangerous his dynamite was. So maybe the Nobel is the name, of course, now that is attributed to all the prizes,
right.
The Peace Prize, and there are six or eight of them. But he originally was the creator of dynamite, for those of you that might not know. The dynamite does go off. It blows the amoeba up into multiple pieces, but to no avail because the pieces seek each other out, I guess you could say, and reform.
Yeah.
Now, here's where things start breaking down a little bit for me story-wise. Up until this point, you have just this mindless thing, which amoebas are not. But okay, this species of amoeba that he found is. Okay, that's fine. It's just moving for whatever reason. It's just, and it just happens to be in the direction of the town, and the town suffers, and you just get out of its way and let it go. And okay, all right, that's fine. But the doctor decides that he is going to lure the amoeba. And to do that, he runs into a house and douses himself with table sugar.
Yeah, from a whole barrel of it.
Yeah, a barrel, first of all. I wasn't aware that people bought for houses sugar by the barrel. Okay. You know, I'm suspending belief suspending disbelief, I'm sorry, because I'm reading comic books. Oh, okay, that's cool. So, and he does, douses himself in sugar, runs out, and because he is covered in sugar, it does attract the amoeba's attention.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right here, story just went completely out the window, because you have two completely different things, the mindless, ambling, for no reason monster, and now the monster that can be attracted by something and thus has enough intelligence, even on a rudimentary level, to react.
Which apparently there was not enough of in an entire town.
No. They're right.
But dousing his coat in it is enough right now.
To attract it away from anything in the town.
Right.
Okay. So, much to my disbelief. He does this, and it works. He remembers something about the townspeople saying that there was a section of the nearby forest that had a pit of quicksand in it, and if I can draw the creature there, it will, whatever, die or become trapped or whatever. But ultimately, that is what I'm going to do, is draw it towards the quicksand, which he does. It is entrapped in the quicksand, becomes a non-problem, I guess, because it kills it ultimately.
Okay.
So now all is safe in the village because the monster was destroyed in the quicksand, and we see some quick morals here in the very last panel.
Yeah.
The doctor. Let's see. Yeah, the doctor says, "Perhaps we have all learned a lesson, my friends. I will no more tamper with secrets which belong to nature herself." And a townsperson responds, "And we swear never again to let our superstitious fears stampede us into attacking those whom we do not understand."
All right, now see, one.
And that's the moral.
One, I can see. The other, no. Nah.
Okay.
I can see the doctor being like, "Oh my God, this was a horrible mistake. I'll never do it again."
Right, right.
But dude, townsperson who's like, "We're not going to let our superstitions ant one." Yes, they will.
Yeah, well, yeah. We know that.
Two, they're not going to get rid of their superstitions either. And three, if someone goes back into that tower, they will be just as superstitious of them as well, and suspicious.
Absolutely. If the Frankenstein castle is reoccupied by someone, yes, it will happen again.
Even if it's made into like a daycare, they will suspect that something is being done to the children in the basement.
Yes.
And another thing for me was, he's like, oh, I remember the townspeople talking about a swamp. And I'm like, when? None of them trusted you.
I don't know. Maybe the week before his experiments started, he, you know, was sitting in the cafe.
Okay, maybe, but they would have been just as suspicious of him then.
Yes, I would think so, because he was an outsider.
And they knew even less about him. So when did he hear this and from whom?
Yeah, you know, I was lost with the sugar thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay. All right, our next story involves Dragoom, D-R-A-G-O-O-M, the Flaming Invader.
And you got to love where he's from.
Yeah. Dragoom here in this first splash page appears as a humanoid bipedal flame monster. That's how he put it. And in the previous one, the giant amoeba was this central blob with pseudopods, tendrils.
Yeah, long tentacle thing.
It was a really odd looking amoeba.
It was about the size of a football field or better.
Finally, yes, when it broke out of the castle.
Yeah, which was by sunrise.
And it didn't move out of the castle. It got so big that the castle couldn't contain it, really, is what happened.
Yeah, but it just burst forth.
All right, so our Dragoom story opens here with VC, Victor Cartwright, there it is the director, I guess, or producer. He's big in Hollywood for horror movies. And he is seen here leading up to the gist of this story at a grand opening of a movie. Afterwards here with a woman in tow. On a set of a movie here is a couple scenes, maybe the same movie, maybe a couple different movies, but ultimately on the set of his next movie, he and his crew witness a falling meteor. Now, those first four or five panels let you know that neither Victor – is that what I said his name was? Yeah, Victor. Nor anyone associated with him puts much stock in his product.
Mm-mm.
He's a hack. He knows he's a hack. Everyone around him knows he's a hack. Perhaps not so much because he is a hack, but because what he puts out is perceived as being hackish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
You know, so it's not that they are bad movies. It's just the type of movie automatically makes them bad, not
right. The science fiction and horror movies, you know,
are lowbrow.
Yeah, they're looked down upon.
Yeah, very much.
But it's the quote unquote art films that is where, you know, high society Hollywood expects you to be,
and that's where Vic wants to be too.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
but this is his lot in life, and it's making him money.
Yeah,
so
he's doing it and doing it and doing it well.
Yeah, doing it well by money standards.
Mm-hmm.
So in the midst of shooting this next film, there's a meteor. They, of course, chase off to find the site of the meteor Earthfall. And when they do, they encounter Dragoom as he is towering above them, saying, "Earthlings, I am Dragoom."
He knows English.
Very well. Yeah, much better than our gypsy or Russian
spies.
Yes, ne'er-do-wells previously. And he is telling them what he's going to do. First here, as Levi alluded to, he says that he is from the planet Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
March 1970.
See, now that's...
Is that after Star Trek?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Star Trek came out in like...
The 60s, I don't know, is it early or 68? Mid? Or was it
65, 68, somewhere in there. Yeah, okay. So they know that they are bogarting Vulcan.
Oh, yeah, they're trespassing on that one hard.
Okay, all right. He says that he – we don't necessarily get the whole story here up front, but – ultimately, Dragoom has escaped. Now, he tells us here. He has escaped from imprisonment on Vulcan and has escaped to Earth and is going to take over Earth because he says, "I am the mightiest life form in the universe. My fire contains the energy of the stars. I can change my shape at will, become any size, and my lifespan is forever. I am Dragoom, the all-powerful. And he says this as he enlarges himself to continental size.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he's standing over the isthmus of is it an isthmus? Maybe it's not an isthmus, but he's standing over Mexico.
Well, that's where they were filming, so.
Is Mexico an isthmus? Yeah, I guess, because a peninsula is surrounded on three sides.
On three sides, yeah.
So, yeah, so isthmus is the right way. Cool.
And it was 1966, by the way.
Star Trek?
Yeah, it debuted in 66 and ran for three seasons.
That's not even right.
No, they had plenty of time. It's been around. It's been around for a while.
It was definitely by choice that they're there.
Well, I mean, they're like, fire, Greek god, or Roman, whichever.
Yeah, whichever one it is.
Vulcan, that makes sense. And someone in the back's like, that's where Spock's from. Shut up, you're an intern, get me coffee.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Okay.
These kids ain't going to know it.
So now Dragoom is going to take over the world.
Yes.
He's going to rule the world. And leaves to,
head north.
Yeah. Is there a reason given why? Did they say anything or?
He was tired of dealing with them? I don't know.
Yeah. I don't believe he did. So as he's going, he encounters.
No, I can tell you exactly why. Because he was going to DC.
Well, but why?
Because if he went to Moscow, then American readers wouldn't care.
Right. Okay. All right. So here we go. He encounters U.S. forces on several different occasions here. Airplane that he melts.
Yeah.
Melts the airplanes but doesn't catch the parachutes on fire.
No.
So the airmen are safe. Yeah. It's just the machinery that's destroyed.
Yep.
Encounters artillery, small arms fire. The rounds burn up before they penetrate him. Mm-hmm. He gets to D.C. and tells everyone that he is going to surround the entire planet with a blanket of flame until they do everything that he says. Excuse me. So he starts enlarging himself, and there's several panels of all this going on, and the people, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Ultimately, one panel here, we see Earth that looks very much like Saturn, only the ring is Dragoom.
Of fire.
Yeah.
It's a burning ring of fire.
Thank you, Johnny. Several panels here of the effects on the people. They're sweating. They're crying out for it to stop. One panel here that shows us that he is definitely in charge because he has descended to a city, and he is sitting upon the ruins of the city as if they were a throne with all the earthlings working beneath him.
You know, it's funny. When I was reading this, I see him encircling the earth and, you know, oh my God, it's getting hotter. And then on the bottom of page six here, you see all these people and it's like, this heat, it's unbearable. We must surrender. And I just, the first thing that popped into my head was a panel on the next page that said, meanwhile in Arizona, wow, winter must have come early this year. I'm like, shut up, people.
I thought that, you know, they should just be told it was a dry heat.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, look, it's a dry heat. You'll be fine. It's better for
you. Yeah, don't worry about it.
Wear your oven mitts to drive, though.
Yeah. Until one of the earthlings, I think, that he encountered before, perhaps even Vic, approaches Dragoom and tells him that there are five of them, and they've landed in Mexico. Then we see him rush off to Mexico, and he encounters five beings like himself.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, it didn't tell us that, but the panel is on the same page, so you quickly see what the beings are.
Right.
Dragoom feels that they are police officers from Vulcan that have come back to capture him, take him back away. He decides that the best thing he can do is to leave Earth, go on the lam, never come back, and they won't find him. You know, mm-hmm. if he stays on the run, they'll never be able to find him. Well, lo and behold, we see that it's Vic and several members of his production crew that have costumes from previous movies that they made, or they made them for this situation, mm-hmm. whichever. They tricked Dragoom into ultimately leaving their planet. And the third story, probably the story that I liked best, is Taboo, the thing from the murky swamp. And this is a story of Lewis Conrad, who is an adventurer. And he writes books about the expeditions that he takes and the adventures that he gets in. So his latest one involves going to the Amazon, which he says he has never done before.
Well, what kind of adventure is worth his salt if he's never been to the Amazon?
I thought that's like where you cut your teeth.
I was going to say, that's like 101.
Yeah, really.
It's like, so, you know, it's like, where are you going for graduation? The Amazon. Where else?
Yeah, exactly. No, the North or South Pole. No, that's later.
Yeah, you know, that's like,
go to the Amazon first.
Yeah, that's 102, right?
Right. That's it. So he's never been there before. He's going. Not much happens. He goes. He gets some guides. Talking about the swamps, this way, this direction kind of thing, and the natives start getting a little antsy, and they say, well, no, not there, because that's where Taboo lives. And he asks, and they tell him, he's the swamp demon. He's the most dangerous of all living creatures. And, of course, he's like, come on. So he goes, leaving all of his porters, all of his guides, because, as typically happens in this situation, the natives know more, and they won't be pushed.
Exactly.
Once that scary thing is encountered, you always know, because that's when the natives leave.
Yeah, it's like when you know, they're willing to drag you out of the jungle, you know, when they've been bitten and you know.
Oh, yeah.
They'll rescue you, but if there's a place where they just refuse to go, I'd stop with them.
Yep, they'll carry your crap. Mm-hmm. They'll put up with anything, mm-hmm. but they won't go into the scary place.
And that's enough for me right there. If they're like, no, we will not go. We're turning back. We're leaving your stuff here. You'll never see us again. I'd be like, okay, hold on. I'm coming
right.
With you.
Whatever you want, but that.
Yeah.
And so you're like, okay, know that. That's fine.
let's go to another scary place that's not as bad. Oh, we know 100. This is the Amazon.
So he doesn't. He forces on. And for the first little bit, it's just a, you know, normal swamp looking thing. Again, this is drawn by Kirby. It's got some particular Kirby features here for me. It's the face of our protagonist. It's a very Kirby looking face. And he gets there, and as he's about to fend off, I guess, an alligator or a crocodile, whichever it would be.
It's a croc.
A crocodile. He notices that the land, the mud behind the crocodile starts moving, and not only is it moving, but it wells up like a big tidal wave or something.
Mm-hmm.
Swamps the crocodile, comes at him, He tries to run away from it, but it catches up and subdues him, grabs him in a big muck hand, holding him up, and then starts communicating with him telepathically. He says, Earthman, do you absorb my thoughts? Which is funny, because that's exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Can you understand? And so they start this discourse back and forth. We find out that this creature is actually an alien that has crash-landed on Earth and wants nothing more than to leave Earth. Earthman, can you help me? And the Earthman agrees to help. What do I need? What can I do? And the alien tells him, well, I need to build another spaceship, but I need to know, you know, what level this planet is at as far as technology, so I know how to direct you to build my ship. I need to know what you know so that I can then tell you how to build my ship.
I'd have been like, dude, sorry, you're SOL.
So he goes back to the United Nations and gives the story to them, and all of the countries in the world agree to compile their scientific data, turn it over to him to be delivered to the creature Taboo, so that Taboo can use the information to then direct the building of his rocket ship. Go back to the Amazon. There's this computerish device about as big as a man. It's ported in, given to Taboo, and immediately Taboo says, "Ha, you fools. You played right into my hands. You gave me all your knowledge. Now I will take this home with me where my race can study it as we prepare to invade your Earth." And he leaves planet. And it's like, oh, so you didn't need a ship.
Yeah.
And as he's flying off, he gets to the, you know, outer reaches of our atmosphere, the edge of space, wherever, out away from where he can do any harm, and he blows up. And Vic says, well, what was that? And these other people that accompanied him told him, well, you know, basically we're not boobs. We put an H-bomb in that device in case the creature tried to do anything like this. And so there is the defeat of the muck alien Taboo, because we humans were smarter than he was.
So we thought.
Or she was.
Yes.
I don't know.
So we thought. Sorry, that's what it says at the end.
Yeah, so we thought. Yeah. There's a sequel.
That's what's called a spoiler.
And that was the three stories for this issue.
Yep.
So you gave Tower of Shadows a thumbs up. What are your thoughts here?
Well, first I got to be honest. By the time I got to the last one, I did not read it. I'm sorry, but I mean, five of these kind of cheesy horror things, and I get to the last one and I see a muck monster named Taboo, and I'm like, I'm not doing it. I can't do it.
No, but it was the best story.
I know now, going through it, I know that now. But at the time, like I said, I'd gone through five of these things already, and I was like, please, no, not another one. So what I did is I was like, I'll go to the last panel and see what happens, so I know how it ends, and that'll be good. But we went through it, and it's like, yeah, I like that one the best.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
But I had to be honest, I didn't read it the first time.
Man, missed the best.
I did. Overall, it wasn't horrible. I mean, so I'm going to give it a thumbs up.
Okay.
But like some of the things that we discussed in the first story with the growing ray and the amoeba and the sugar and the
ray. Yeah.
So there were some issues with that. With the second story, it was like you see the big flaming guy and it's like, I mean, can't they like make better looking bad guys?
Well, it was kind of an elemental theme, I guess. You know, fire, earth.
Yeah, I know, but it's like, you know, that's. But it's not even if I were like six. That's not scary. It's just.
It's not. Doesn't seem to be stretching imagination a whole lot.
And you know. And so I was like, okay, well, whatever. That's a thing for the time. They didn't do scary well, or. At least not in these. So okay, whatever.
Yeah, the comics code, I guess, probably kept them pretty tame, you know.
Right. So I'm like, okay, well, move on. So story, crash lands. There he is. Okay. Well, okay. You're doomed. He wants to reign. Da 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 da. Okay. No big deal. He, you know, I want to rule. Da 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 da. And then, you know, he's like surrounding the planet with fire. And seriously, I'm like, dude, I lived in Arizona. Yeah, you ain't got nothing. You know, it's a dry heat. Just shut up, seriously. But then the Vulcan thing got me, and I was like, really? This is like 1970, guys. Come on, know better. But then how they beat him, I thought was kind of a little weak.
Yeah,
he sees five of them, and he's like. I'm out. I mean, he doesn't confront them at all. He doesn't challenge them at all.
Yeah.
He doesn't attack them at all, which just any one of those things, and he would have been able to see through their ruse, but he didn't do it. And that's just – that would have been, I think, uncharacteristic of just about anyone, you know.
Well, if he's wanting to set up his own fiefdom here on Earth.
Well, isn't he going to want to defend it?
Yeah, it's like you're not even willing to defend it. You're just going to tuck tail and run?
Yeah, but then he's like, I'll go where they can never find me. I'll never again return to Earth. And I'm thinking, how convenient. I'll go beyond their power to follow. I'll never stop fleeing, never. And I'm thinking, how even more convenient.
Yep.
And then, you know, it's like, oh, it's just cardboard cutouts on sticks. And I'm like, really? No.
The only possible defense is, well, they only had 7 pages to work with.
I know, but it's just, you know, I mean, it's like lead up. Oh.
Yeah. Now, and you're saying that as an adult.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 7, 8 years old, it would have been more entertaining. Which I can't help but think is who they were gearing up
for. Okay, I can see as a 7 or 8 year old being like, oh man, we beat them with cardboard cutouts and that was it. That is so cool. Okay, I can see that possibility.
Perhaps, yeah, so.
But I'm, again, not reading these or critiquing them as an adult, so.
Yeah, I know.
And now, that we went through Taboo, yeah, I kind of liked it the best. I thought also that even as short as it was, which is just as short as the others,
right,
it was better fleshed out.
Yeah, it was a little tighter writing, yeah.
The one thing that I didn't like is the fact that he goes to the UN and gets everyone to sign off on, you know, like helping this alien get back to the planet, and we can't even, you know, do like any climate change agreements in the UN. But
but
they agree to help an alien get off the planet.
Well, perhaps in 1970, the UN was much friendlier than it is now.
Maybe I don't know, but I was just like, really?
Yeah,
like
that's pretty telling.
That's what everybody came together for.
Maybe that's what we need to do, is to trick everybody and say, hey, why don't you give us your information?
And that was the other thing. It's like all the world's information. And I'm like, yeah, because that'll happen.
Yeah, really.
Here's everything we know about science. Promise. You know, so. But other than that, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't bad. That was, to me, the biggest thing.
Yeah, it definitely was the tightest story. I mean, they, you know, something happened and they destroyed the monster.
And yeah, the end I liked too, because it's
there,
like the monster turned on them and they're like, you know, just in case.
Yeah.
We'll put it on remote detonation. So, you know, we're going to be helpful, but we're not going to be stupid about it. So, and yep, we were right. Look at there. Boom.
All right. So is that a thumbs up for this one too?
Yeah. Overall, it's a thumbs up.
Okay. I'll second that. I'll give this one a thumbs up. Probably a better thumbs up than Tower of Shadows. I like these nameless monsters like this more than that horror story kind of thing. So I guess the first book was horror stories and this was more like monster stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like monster stories better. But both of them, for me, both of them were entertaining. Yeah, you're right. Both books having 3 stories, not the bestest stories in the world necessarily. You know, they're 7 pages, quick hits, you know, so it's kind of a – I don't necessarily want to keep reading a whole book like mm-hmm. this, but, well, there's only one more story, and I can read one more 7-page story. So overall, I like the full, you know, 22-page stories like we've been getting in the superhero mm-hmm. book. Usually, now even still yet, not all the time.
Yeah.
Usually, they're a lot better thought out and planned out, and you know, so not that they don't have just as many logic holes or whatever else that we might run across. Tower of Shadows 4 was a thumbs up for both of us, and Where Monsters Dwell was a thumbs up from both mm-hmm. of us. So that's pretty good. Overall, we've been giving thumbs up far more often than thumbs down to these books.
That's because they're not romance.
Well, yes. Or humor.
Or humor.
T Teeny Bobby or Booby Dooby, or you know, whatever the books are called. Next time, guys, we have X-Men issue 66. That's like the original X-Men, not nowhere near the same title that you would see called X-Men now. And Amazing Spider-Man 83. So, wow, I didn't realize Spider-Man had been around that long. He's been out for a while. So that's next time. We've already thanked Toothnasher for Dilapidated, our word of the show.
Dilapidated.
I can't think of anything else that I wanted to get out there, Levi. Do you?
No.
All right, guys, if you want to leave us feedback, or perhaps one of you listeners want to send us a word of the show, several different ways you can do it. You can tweet Marvel Bronze Age and give us the word of the show, or give us whatever feedback you want in 140 characters or less. Marvel Bronze Age is on Facebook and Google Plus. You can leave comments there. Every time a new episode comes out, Marvel Bronze Age has a page on both of those, and the show goes up on the page, allowing you to leave comments. The email address is themarvelbronzeage@gmail.com, and the website is bigtimenoise.com/Marvel Bronze Age.
Mm-hmm.
So leave us comments, feedback, word of the show. We'll do our best to get any and all of those on the next episode. Otherwise, we will see you in approximately a fortnight.
Yes.
So we'll talk to you guys next time.
Peace.
The Marvel Bronze Age podcast is a Teal production, and as such is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Non-Derivatives 3.0 Unported license. The song Super Freaks is provided and performed by the Hammerheads.